The last time we met, you sent down for something under whom? Very much.
My name is Tietzi Sedona from the Free Speech.
My name is Lenin from Asan Couch, not member of the committee.
Colega Tondas is Minister of Asan Couch.
I'm Tasha Tietzi from the province that has the most spoken official language, Limpopo.
I'm not sure why honorable members wanting to qualify their
provinces.
It's proud of
Okay, those are honorable. Yeah, if you want to enjoy the sunshine, come to the Northern Cape.
This is no time to advertise. I'm sure there are checks that in place that will do so.
Ngiyabulela mhlali ngaphambili. Ngithatha leli thuba ukwethula ithimba elihamba nalo. I would like to take this opportunity to introduce the delegation from PANSAS. I am the new CEO of PANSAS. I was appointed on the 5th of March. 2007. All my life, I have Mr. Nkosi, not a relative of mine. Not my son, and definitely not my husband. My son is already appointed. He is the manager of communications and marketing and the head of strategy. On my left is my provincial manager in the office of the of the Tanzania African Language Board in Western Cape. Next to him is Dr. Busisiwe Dube, who is currently a postdoctoral research fellow studying language learning in complex multilingual contexts such as border towns. Dr. Dube has taught at a number of universities in the studied region, written extensively on the acquisition of African languages. She is together with Professor Sinfri Maponi, who has taught at the University of Western Cape. Professor Maponi is professor in language research. He also has written extensively in language issues, currently one of Africa's most senior researchers in language studies. Why I am giving their titles and what they've done. They have been commissioned by PANSA to support us in our strategy exercise to take the organization forward. As we have just finished 10 years of our existence, we need to actually reflect on what the organization has done in the area of promotion of our languages. They are here as a support team to give the evidence of what I'm presenting to you, honorable members. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Now that we know who is here formally, we can now engage. But I must start by saying we are a little disappointed. Sorry. But because we would have really loved to have seen your presentation some days before, so that we go through the presentation, so that when we meet here, we might be in a position to engage in a meaningful way. And if we receive it here and now and expect us to engage here and now, it's a little restricting on our part. We just hope that in the future when we've got the engagement of this data, we will be able to get documentation in time. So that when we come into the meeting, all of us are moving on the same wavelength in terms of understanding the document. I asked the Secretary of the Committee, days ago as to whether we have received if the documentation, you are saying no, there's no documentation yet. You are going to receive it yesterday. Then I said, so how do you engage this concept when there is no documentation? The issue is made, we will engage, and but in future I'm sure they will correct this anomaly.
May I extend our apology, Chairperson, and indicate that it was equally a very challenging task for the organization because we received an invitation on the 23rd of July. And at that time, the CEO was launching isiZulu Dictionary at KwaZulu-Natal. And from that launch, the CEO attended a strategic workshop which he had long organized, which was on the from the Thursday, the 20th. 28, 29, and I came back to the office on Monday to receive the letter. I think that is what happened. It's not that we do not respect this audacious committee, it was just an issue of time. And our apologies, in fact, we would like this honorable house to further engage us, and we are very appreciative of this opportunity that you have invited us, and we would like this to be a norm rather than just a check. Thank you, honorable chair.
Yeah, no, I was just engaging the Secretary of the Secretary. He said that found out from him, it's just like, well, it's usually not the way to talk to you or take it in some way. So I would have thought that communication came to you at that particular time. And he tells you that, now that communication came as you indicated now, which last. Because you are speaker from stage and like, you know, because you are not speaking, but for the future, I thought that he was taking that to you at that particular time. Then if you got the indication in July, then you tell that he didn't. So good, I'm telling you, this is the
but what we would like to follow attention to say is exactly what we identified in our strategic planning process, that we as Panta do not have a representative here in Panta, in Parliament, and this is what we intend to change. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Because engaging in the department of other cultures, some people would have thought that
they are
going to
win you.
Honourable Chair and members of this Honourable House, may I present to you the format of our presentation. I will lead the presentation with the slide show, after which I will hand over to the research team, which research team would be then supporting some of the issues that I would have raised in the main presentation. And then I would allow the provincial manager in Western Cape to give you just a signal of what PANTAS is doing at the provincial level. That will be the structure of our presentation. Honorable Chair and members, let me first address what PANTAS is about, the legislative mandate. The legislative mandate of the Pan South African Language Board, PANTAS, is found in the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, the 10th South Act, and the Public Finance Management Act. The powers and functions of the board are, and I quote, to make recommendations with regard to any proposed or existing legislation, practice and policy dealing directly or indirectly with language, methods at any level of government, underlying at any level of government, and with regard to any proposed amendment to or the review or the placement of such legislation, practice and policy. B. Make recommendations to organs of state at all levels of government where it considers such an action advisable for the adoption of measures aimed at the promotion of multilingualism within the framework of the Constitution. C. Actively promote an awareness of multilingualism as a national resource. This is our view, that if we all embrace multilingualism, South Africa will be much richer, and we will actually deal with issues of reconciliation and issues of national building if we embrace the principles of multilingualism. We actively promote development of the previously marginalized languages. Our language has been under domination for more than two centuries. That is why the Constitution lifted out this aspect that they have to be developed. C. Initiate studies and research aimed at promoting and creating conditions for the development and use of one, all the official languages of the Republic, two, Khoi and Sign languages, and South African Sign Language. And promote and ensure respect for all other languages commonly used by the communities in South Africa. This is why we say we are a multilingual society. We have got our indigenous languages, including Khoi, Sign, and Nam languages. And also we have got these heritage languages, which we have actually inherited from are those of our citizens who come from other countries, and they have their home where they come from. That is why our mandate is to develop the official languages, including Sen, Nam, and Khoi, and sign language. But these other ones, we just give them space so that they can flourish. G, advise on the coordination of language planning in South Africa. Hansard plays a crucial role when the National Language Services within the Department of Arts and Culture came with two legislations. One, the South African Languages Act, or South African Languages Bill, which is in Parliament as we speak, and would like to address the House on that issue. That it has taken a long time for that legislation not to come to be promulgated. The second legislation is the National Language Policy Framework, which the Parliament recently, because the Cabinet has said, has actually sent out a message to government departments that it is time that that legislation is being implemented. It was issued by Parliament in 2003, but up to now, HANSARP has found out that actually departments have not implemented this important legislation. I will address myself to that issue later. H, facilitate cooperation with language planning agencies outside South Africa. So, HANSARP is currently developing relationship with African Languages Teachers Association in USA. In fact, it is ironical that African languages are outside South Africa, maybe even outside Africa. There is a whole body of knowledge outside South Africa in which we can share. There is also a relationship with Canadian Linguistic Rights Association, where Professor Margaret, my previous CEO, and the chairperson of the board visited this institution so that we can exchange information on this important issue. There is an indirect relationship with HANSARP through the European Union. There is a project which is currently run by an individual in cooperation with HANSARP. It's called AfriLingo, where we are promoting multilingualism in Parliament, in different provincial education and municipality. So this is the kind of cooperation that we have. We also have an association with a very strong body, the ALASA, the African Languages Association. Establish provincial language committees and national bodies to advise it on any language matter affecting a province or a specific language. We have all these structures. HANSARP is lucky to have actually implemented that policy. We now have 11 provincial language committees. We have 30 national language bodies, and these are the bodies that are in that have got the mandate to develop our previously marginalized languages, including English and African language. But what is challenging here is that these bodies are on an ad hoc basis. They are merely appointed and they serve a certain period of time, and their term of office elapses. And that is a concern for us. This is what we raise at our community planning, that this issue needs to be addressed. A, establish national lexicography unions to operate as companies limited by guarantee under Section 21 of the Companies Act, and allocate funds to the units for the fulfillment of their functions. I will indicate, for instance, that the bulk of the budget is actually going to this NLU. But I'm happy to report to Parliament that we have since received some products out of this National Lexicography Unit. As I've indicated earlier on, I was at KwaZulu-Natal during the launch of isiZulu Monolingual Dictionary. And you may remember that we also launched isiXhosa, the Greater isiXhosa Dictionary, with three volumes. And this is a milestone on our side. And we are we are happy to report that even Sibenda now has a bilingual dictionary. Suswati has a bilingual dictionary. Susani Boa has got a bilingual dictionary. There is this groundswell of a movement into us actually affirming our languages, our previously marginalized languages. Maybe now let me move to the vision of the organization. Our vision is to achieve the equal status and use of all official languages of South Africa, as well as core non languages and the South African Sign Language. Our mission is to provide for the recognition, the promotion, and the development of all South African official languages underlined, because sometimes people confuse us with CRN. We are mandated to look specifically for the development of the official languages, with particular attention being given to those languages that were previously marginalized. Our values are respect for all languages in South Africa, equal treatment of all languages in South Africa, non-discrimination on the basis of language. The overview of our past, of the past performance. In pursuance of the vision and mission, and being informed by the Transact Act, the board has established the following structures, namely 13 national language bodies representing each of the 11 official languages, SEM, NAM, and CO, and Sign Language, 11 national lexicography units, and 9 provincial language committees. These structures are tasked with different responsibilities. For example, the national language bodies focus on the development of each official language, as well as KOI, NAM, and SEM languages, sign language in South Africa, in terms of standardizing through verification and authentication, developing and promoting these languages' literature and addressing language in education matters. Provincial language committees, on the other hand, are responsible for status planning, linguistic rights mediation, and protecting against linguistic violations. In this regard, CANSAL has held a number of hearings on behalf of individuals and groups whose language rights have been violated. This is why I brought in a test case of how we do this. This research team that is present here today is going to indicate to us how do we test our impact in the public. How do we test our impact to the citizens of South Africa? This is going to come out in the presentation. In this regard, CANSAL has heard today, and I'm saying provincial language committee also advise SEC and government departments in terms of language matters. For example, we expect government departments by now to have implemented the national language policy framework of the National Language Services. But not all departments have set up language units within their sections. So how can they implement when they've not even set up the language units? This is, in our view, a blatant violation of citizens' rights. The concomitant result of this neglect to institute these language units has caused unwarranted suffering of the ordinary South African citizens. This is what the research team is going to point out. CANSAL welcomes the National Cabinet announcement on the 24th of July, I need to be corrected on the date, that compels all government departments to set up language policy units. This is the step in the right direction, given what has been alluded to above. Now, I would like to take you back on the CANSAL spending pattern, which is one of the issues that we have highlighted, that for us to deliver according to our mandate, we need to have sufficient money so that all this mandate, because we have got a very huge mandate. The administrative functions of the board are performed by staff appointed and managed by the chief executive officer, who is accountable to the board and to parliament. The budget of Tantal has shown some growth over the past 5 years, from 19 million over 2002 and 2003 financial year to 39,095,000 for the 2006-2007 financial year. The allocation for the 2007-2008 financial year is the amount of 43,600,000 with a further 47,112,000 allocated for 2008-2009. You can see that this allocation is very minimal. We cannot carry this huge money with this kind of allocation. A breakdown of Tantal's budget in the past few years demonstrates an upward trend in salary spending patterns, particularly moving from 21.55% in 2003 to 30.23% in 2006 at the Tantal head office and the provincial offices. As far as direct spending on the core business is concerned, an average of 47.62% over the past 5 years was dedicated to this expense. The biggest chunk, which is 36.53%, went to the National Lexicography Unit, which are charged with the development and application of dictionaries in all the official languages. The balance has been utilized for the National Language Bodies and Provincial Language Committee to revise, inter alia, the spelling and orthography rules, as well as to standardize the community and also launch campaigns in terms of the language use in all sectors of government. I may not go through that document, which is just an indication how our spelling pattern has been and the progress that we have been actually studying. Allow me, Honorable Chair, to give you a situation analysis of CASA. This is what we were engaging in during our strategic planning. Areas that can need to be addressed urgently. First, let us look at what is CASA, who is CASA. CASA is not clearly noticeable among the public, organs of state, and other constitutional bodies. Our profile needs to be raised. I was surprised when a colleague of mine raised the issue that a very important organ of state asked whether we are a constitutional body, because he said we do not appear in the constitution. Actually, this was asked to me, and I had to show this representative, this honorable member, that we are there in the constitution. Otherwise, how can people who are so important do not know who we are? And just if we just know who we are, how can we stand? So those are the issues that we are actually concerned about. Two, CASA is not sufficiently funded, as I alluded. The Department of Arts and Culture allocates funds as it is. In other words, it's a perceived need, it's not what we actually and according to our money. As a result, Tantal structures are not adequate to fund the issue to their money. National language bodies and provincial language committee members are not full-time, and this hampers their ability to perform and deliver on the ground. You'll find that there will be a time when these bodies are constituted, and that time when they are not in place, who is doing the job? So this is the kind of challenges that we are facing. There is a need to review CASA checks due to its shortcomings. For instance, it obligates CASA, a constitutional body, to table its report to Parliament via the Office of the Minister of Arts and Culture, rather than reporting directly to Parliament. We need to actually engage with the Department of Arts and Culture. Yes, we need to have consent and interactions, but this is the area where we have got consent. Who do we report to? That is the area that we would like to be addressed. Now, we have also been able to look internally. Internally, there are weak systems and processes that need urgent attention. The communication and marketing manager is currently coming up with a communication strategy which will address some of the weaknesses internally. The human resource system, which was actually planned when I arrived at the organization, there was no one. There was just one person who had just been appointed. It was just a very pathetic situation. And Parliament, when we made the suggestion earlier on in March and April, this issue was raised. The issue of staff takeover, limited career mobility, poor reward system, and low staff morale was highlighted in that presentation. The information system is also in the communication strategy which Mr. Mbosi is taking care of. Now, when we were sitting in this strategic planning, we actually identified strategic priorities. This is over and above the strategic goals that the board has actually mandated us to actually implement. But these key strategic priorities are the ones which will take Panthers forward, are the ones which will assist the organization to deal with the current weaknesses that we have alluded to. We need to perform a critical appreciation of Panthers' effectiveness, which is why, for example, we've got a research team doing that for us, but we would like this to be an ongoing exercise, not just one-off event. This is what I said, we perform a critical appreciation of Panthers' effectiveness, understanding forces that are supporting and against organizational performance, clarify the performance gap, and come up with action plans to eliminate such a gap. Two, develop an operating model enabling consistent management, understanding of the performance imperatives of Panthers, its key drivers, and how they impact delivery of the organization's mandate. Three, to monitor, evaluate, and communicate the impact of Panthers to its stakeholders and customers. And I would like to unpack these key strategic priorities. If you look at the first strategic option one, we are saying, let us first of all engage Parliament with a view to enable Panthers Act to tighten some aspects of its legislation on enforcement against non-compliant organizations. For example, to ensure compliance by departments to deliver on the decision of cabinet to establish language units with a view to implementing the national language policy framework. Panthers must be empowered to enforce compliance. At this point in time, that aspect of legislation is very weak. We need to strengthen that so that we can then support Parliament in its endeavor to promote multilingualism, to ensure that South African citizens are given this right. Secondly, we would like to embark on rigorous awareness campaigns across all government spheres and private sector for the mandate of Panthers. Three, we'd like to develop partnerships with relevant institutions. As we speak now, we are engaging Microsoft on the issue of developing what we call a multilingual institute, where Panthers can trade different aspects on multilingualism. We have, for instance, the University of KwaZulu-Natal, which has implemented a multilingual policy, but where are we going to get access to our multilingual? There is one thing that South African citizens must appreciate. The indigenous people are very lucky that they are already multilingual. We must take that as a result and give them the resources so that they are able to teach at school using this resource, teach at university. Go and train our children to become film makers, film producers in all our languages. Let us take, for instance, as an example, people in Gauteng, they speak more than 6 languages. That is a resource. We are saying we can take that resource and translate it so that it can benefit our people. This is what Panthers want to do. When we get into this partnership with Microsoft, we are going to develop an institute where our children come and then they go to university. We are seeing universities dragging their feet towards complying with the issues of material. So Panthers want to have the muscle to be able to do this. We must have an enabling environment to do this. The next strategy is policy number two. let us unpack it. You are saying, this is you and defending human resource services, organizational stability, and performance to deliver on our money. This is where we are satisfied that we have a vision. To acquire information systems, risk management, to review and reconcile the Panthers Act to ensure consistency with the Public Service Act and with the Public Finance Management Act. There are certain loopholes there. This is what I've identified. One of the reasons why we had such a high staff turnover. We are using Public Service Act as an underpinning legislation. But in terms of operation, there is no integration. When a person who wants to come to Panthers, who is living from, who is coming from the Department of Education, it's difficult to come into Panthers. And equally, when this person leaves from Panthers, going to other government departments, it's difficult. So we need to synchronize these pieces of legislation in terms of the regulation. So these are the issues that I would like to address as I go on, as the chief of the captain of the state. We need to review the remuneration structure of the members of PSC, NLP, and NLU to make that of the board members in order to attract quality contributors. We have not a problem. We are beginning to lose people, quality people, because there is this, there's a disparity between what is paid the PSCs who sit in this crucial structure and the board members. And yet, National Treasury has already approved a certain benchmark for payment of the members who pay for levels and matters. And in fact, I've already alluded to the fact that I'm not happy that these structures are on the ad hoc basis, because there is an issue there where we are not able to actually contact them as we want because they are working elsewhere. Let us look at the fellowship of priority number 3. We need to reaffirm the organization's vision and purpose. If we have to approach the board around the vision so that we actually touch it. You must know that in any organization, after we spend 10 years, we actually reflect on whether the vision is still what we had actually designed it to 10 years ago. We need to develop 12 to 36 months strategic framework goals and objectives. Translate such goals into Panthers operations model with clear priorities for people perspective, internal process perspective, customer, financial, and stakeholder perspective. My colleagues are going to unpack this one. This is why we are proposing that we need to have an in-house research group which will be able to check on our effectiveness. These are some of the issues that we have to look into when they want to see whether Panthers is delivering according to its mandate or not. We need to cascade the Panthers balance scorecard to all the units and develop unit scorecards, translate unit scorecards into individual performance contracts, use the core scorecard as input to performance management and review system of the total organization. We then came up with a proposed structure which we believe would be able to deliver to make us deliver according to our mandate. This is the operational structure that we have come up with. As you can see, we have the CEO which is there at the top, and then the manager office, the manager of the CEO office is not existing. The manager of monitoring and evaluation unit is not there. The parliamentary officer is not there. This is what I was talking about. That is why there is this breakdown of context, because we do not have a dedicated officer who is taking care of Panthers issues and parliamentary issues, and there is that communication between the two organizations. We need to have the deputy CEO that is in charge of the language unit. The language unit at the present moment are coordinated in a very loose manner, and I would like to strengthen that one, where we have a deputy CEO who is in charge of this language unit. And this language unit, I'm talking here, if you look at the budget, the language in education, the language and linguistic rights unit, the translation and interpreting unit, the various unpacking of our mandate, those units need to report to a senior member. then you need to have a GCO for provincial managers, because this is, these are the people who are our hands and feet in the world for the provinces. They interact with the MCs. They interact with mayors and party structures. They are doing a lot of work, but there is no clear what is called control there, because we have got very limited staff complement. And then, of course, we currently had a CFO who was appointed when I joined the organization. He was appointed before me, just assumed his office thereafter. Then we have the Hands-Up Stakeholder Performance Prison, which my colleague is going to speak to this one. I may not actually delve on this one. I would like at this point to give the research team an opportunity just to give you a microcosm of what I'm talking about in terms of the effectiveness of the organization, the importance of the state to support our strategy and our mandate, which is the promotion of South African languages. Over to you, colleagues.
Thank you very much for coming. Can I find out how long is it going to take you to make up the decision? This one should have worked out. But this is going to take another hour, and it is five to three nights. Because you see, we were sometimes budgeted 2 hours, 2.5 hours. So how long is it going to take, more or less?
More or less 30 minutes.
More or less 30 minutes.
If not less.
If not less. If you go, it is a little bit less. Okay.
Our role here is to intermediate between what the CEO has said and the nature of the state project that we are engaging. I'm going to begin by, in a very short hand manner, identifying about 3 or 4 principles, then my colleague will take over and I'll be more or less intervening at different points. Hands Up is unique in Africa, in the sense that it is the only constitutionally mandated body to deal with language issues. There are a number of different language associations, which are also called language committees, language boards across Africa, but those are set up by individuals from the country. And but Hands Up is different because it is constitutionally mandated, so that is one thing. Two, for Hands Up, multilingualism is a result. But that basically means multilingualism is beneficial cognitively, emotionally, and socially. And one aspect, if there is any reason why we should be multilingual, is that as you grow older, you stand a much better chance of not being cognitively disadvantaged if you are multilingual. That's the only reason why you should be multilingual. You are better off if you are multilingual and older than if you are monolingual and older. That's where we start. Why are we interested in marginalized languages? If your language is marginalized, you are also marginalized as
well.
Well, and then when we talk about the development of language standardization, what we are trying to do is to correct the way the languages were standardized in the past. They were standardized abyssally. But now, what Hands-Up is interested in doing is to see how the standardization can be carried out by bringing in the community. Hands-Up is a constitutionally mandated policy. Unlike other associations, including universities, they have the capacity to carry out research programs over a long period of time. Because there are certain issues that only become clear with time. So Hands-Up is interested not in projects, but in programs, long-term activities. Now I hand over to my colleague, who will be interviewing my different students.
You were sort of contacted by Hands-Up to look at the language decline in their complaints. Sankar had rights to conclusion that the complaints that they were receiving over the years had continually been reducing. They were getting less and less over the years. We therefore stress that complaints in principle are just language, about language barriers. Now we asked, we hypothesized. There were three hypotheses that we tested. We told ourselves that since over a period of 10 years, from 1997 to 2007, Tamil has been receiving complaints. And over this period of time, there was a high likelihood that Tamil had done such a wonderful job, that there were no complaints in the entire community, in the entire community of South Africa that related to language violations. That would change the disaster of success.
What is crucial here is to realize just one thing, if one has to remember anything from this meeting, is that the violations of language rights in our scholarly work is divided into two. The right to language, which is different from the right of language. That is.
We also hypothesized that there was a high possibility that Tamsas as an organization was to the extent that this decline was the result of despondency among the complainants. In other words, the complainants had been lodging complaints to Tamsas, but Tamsas was taking so much time, to resolve this complaint, to the extent that possibly, out of despondency, the South African populace no longer complained to Tamsas. Alternatively, that these complaints that we have under such normal circumstances gone to Tamsas were now channeled elsewhere. So we call that the inefficiency hypothesis. The last hypothesis was what we call the ineffectiveness hypothesis, or what came up during the research as the toothless bulldog hypothesis. The ineffectiveness hypothesis meant that in as much as Tamsas dealt expeditiously with the complaints that came to them, there was a problem that Tamsas only can make recommendations. There are no proper sanctions that you can enforce where on the person who is violating another individual's language rights. So whenever there was a violation, Tamsas will intervene but make a recommendation, and therefore that was the end of the story.
What is then this, what you ask, which perspective of Tamsas as inefficient or ineffective are we talking about? And is this, are this perception shared by a number of different constituencies within the
government? I need to point out that briefly in our findings so far, the findings are complex, but there is an indication that there is an element of a disaster of success where Tamsas has dealt effectively with the complaint to the extent that that particular community that was an active complainant to Tamsas is no longer coming through. The element of inefficiency was not found to be in existence. If anything, we were so pleasantly surprised that most of the people that had complained to Tamsas indicated that Tamsas dealt with the complaint efficiently, that they were very careful, that the turnaround time was exceptionally good for a government department. Now, when we come to the third hypothesis, that is the ineffectiveness hypothesis or the toothless bulldog hypothesis, the results were mixed. At this particular point, we can certainly say there are indications that Tamsas is ineffective to some extent. I need to highlight the point that this ineffectiveness, as we try to interrogate it over and over again, was coming from the fact that most of the respondents perceive that the legislation as it stands at the moment does not allow Tamsas to impose heavy sanctions on those who violate they stated that the problem was that in a much as Tamsas can make recommendations, he can't do anything against that. We are exactly the Tamsas legal advisor to unpack this claim.
Interesting, George. The way the people will say that it was also just the powers of Tamsas for limited. They did not want an overpowerful body to deal with language issues. That is what we call positive denial.
Now, we have been speaking about language violation. Well, that's a central point in our text. But we need to define what a language violation is. The reason from our perspective is that why we need a clear definition of what a language violation is that we have strong reservations from what CANCAL defines as a language violation, or what CANCAL defines as a language complaint. We felt that during a period of 10 years, CANCAL has dealt with 385 complaints, but those are not the only complaints that CANCAL has received. CANCAL has received far much more than that, but quite a bit of that population has been siphoned into the dustbin of it's not a language violation in fact. Now, the second question is, why are these language violations socially, educationally, and recreationally significant?
This is important. What we now know, which all of us know here, is that people spend a lot of time outside work and outside school, recreation, I mean, whether they're going to party, etc. And we now know that whatever they do outside school, outside parliament, has got an effect on how they function. So there's now a clear connection that we can make between recreation and education.
Now, defining language violation. We came up with a very broad definition. Taking into consideration the mandate of CANCAL, we felt that language violation can be defined as language practices that do not uphold the spirit of the language service in the South African Constitution. That's very broad. But there were three parameters we need to thought that language violations could arise. One, the first parameter is lack of equity in the use of official language in the area of experiences relevant to the South African population. Second, lack of parity of the scheme in the use of all official languages. Three, lack of facilitation in the development of languages to meet the demand expected of them, that is the language in question, apparently.
It's very clear to everybody here that societies are becoming increasingly more and more technologized. The key issue therefore is to what extent can these languages be developed and develop special vocabularies that enable us to deal with new technology.
But why are language relevant to socially, educationally, and recreationally? In our discussion, there was a very strong statement that in a very broad sense, people associate the issue of language with citizenship. I'll quote in one instance when we were interviewing someone who had presented their complaint to CANCAL. He said, when he had got a response from whoever he was complaining about in a particular language, he felt that the second class citizenship and not a South African. So in fact, we view that in a broad sense, the notion of the citizenship in talking about issues of language. Of course, there are various strands that fall into the category of citizenship, but we view the issue of language violations as falling very strongly in the South African context to linguistic citizenship.
And since Parliament, one of the main issues of Parliament is that they may advise on what to do is to deal with issues about citizenship. You can't deal with issues about citizenship without addressing how the members of South African country or South African community deal with their rights to language and right of language.
Now, looking at the complaints, or what we call language violations in practice, we sort of have to categorize this. Look at the nature and type of complaints. First, there were complaints that dealt with inscriptions written in the public space. One example was the Reserve Bank. Someone was very upset that the Reserve Bank, when you up. The front part of the
resistance
is written in English.
So in this case, what is important is, what CANCAL is doing is to argue that if multilingualism is a resource, it's not only in terms of the language that it speaks and to each other and what to write, but the nature of how the landscape, the physical landscape in which you live, the nature of the writings and the language is used to in those particular landscapes. In other words, multilingualism is a result of CANCAL because it affects environment.
The educational space was one that touched us a lot. In fact, we really felt the pain of the complaints. More so because in the pool of these 385 complaints, they were all adults. But if the educator says, we did find a minor who felt their language rights had been violated because he or she was not being taught in their mother tongue, and they took the letter up. And this was a 15-year-old. And that reminded us of one thing. It reflected back to 1973.
At this point, we don't know how many other students, for example, out there, would have been able to launch their complaints if they knew about us.
There were complaints coming from the business and professional sector. Who is complaining today? There are organizations and pressure groups. I wouldn't go into naming all those organizations because I think it's not particularly interesting. But what we found out was that within organizations and pressure groups, there were organizations that were serial complainants. There were groups that we ended up putting up as a serial complainant that year in and year out, they were complaining about a particular language. In the individual group, there were also individuals who were serial complainants as well. In one instance, it was a family where year in and year out, the education was language, husband and wife and
my view about it, I mean, is that this couple, this is the marital question, is that if the husband was not complaining about the wife, or the wife was not complaining about the husband, they said he complained about his son.
But one interesting aspect that came up here was that we were beginning to get the impression that the complaints, specifically the majority of the complaints, let's cut across, do our two anthropologists and see what happens to those that aren't that, well, not aren't so intellectually sophisticated, but haven't risen to that level of being called by tigers and all that. Right across the region, we found out clearly no one, black, white, Indian, colored, whatever you want to call them, know about Panther. The classic case for us was one instance where this white guy will ask him about Panther, about language rights and all that. And he thought, clearly he was very convinced that no, they got it all wrong. Panther was part of the Peter Hart. So in that way, that is the ordinary person really low down there. They don't know about Panther. And yet, if one could view language as service delivered, then as part of service delivered, then Panther is taking the issues, is taking things up there, but the real need, where people are in need, or where people language violations are strong, do not know about Panther. I'll give an example of my the lady who takes care of my house. I asked her, I interrogated her about Panther and all that. Then I said to her, okay, remember that I am the real, so I see the, if you don't speak the real and I check you out of your job and say you can't speak anyone in my family, what will you do? She said, I'll try and look for another job. There is a problem there. I would be violating her language rights if I started discriminating on the basis of language that I didn't say to her. She has recourse to go to Panthers and make a complaint, but because she doesn't know, she will be unemployed.
You can't complain at the Panthers if you don't know the Panther basis.
Simply that. Anyway, collectively, at this particular point, we have picked up that there are limitations which have led to First, the legal definition of a complaint, which Panthers is using. I'll give you an example of one of the instances where I still feel very strongly that the complaint was cut down. The complainant was working in a particular organization where the policy in the workplace was that they speak English and nothing else. The complainant then had a caller who was to bed and they responded to bed, and the person was therefore suspended and later dismissed. The organization's argument was that when they have a policy in the workplace, it states that the language of the workplace is none other than English. Now, Panthers said it was a labor issue because there was a general policy which the employee acknowledged knowing about. And therefore, in that case, it was not a first language complaint. But the flip side of that is that Panthers' role is part of the social transformation and nation building project. This organization came up with this particular policy a long time back. And this policy does not seem to be current yet in South Africa. And this organization, when it got here, it still maintains, well, it's English. And that is the problem that we have.
Because and that I just talked about is very interesting. Was of a gentleman who lodged a complaint with Panther. Panther picked up the complaint and went to court. When we followed this gentleman and asked him, he felt very, very bad. He said, they took my case, but they didn't go forward with me. So you felt that Panthers has become too powerful to exclude the individual who it was supposed to represent. He also wanted to go to court and represent himself, rather than simply being represented by what? By Panthers.
Going to the next point, the literacy level seems to play a significant role in how Panthers does this. Panthers written complaints. A good part of the South African population is thoroughly illiterate, black, white, pink, whatever color they are illiterate. And therefore, oral complaints are necessary. In other words, there is a way in which they stand up this open application of people to present issues orally. We found that as part of the limitation. The third part was lack of publicity of the role and function of Panther. Surely, if 10 years after independence, people think that Panther is a Peter Hart
shooting. The issue is the issue. Panther so far has been waiting for people to come to. The
to ask what should be happening, that cancer should be going to the people.
Now, the youth assembled to bring this cancer offer, we are still to think about it. But it does basically come in through our data that there are people who feel that the youth assembled within which cancer operates is rather limited. Although there are also those that feel that, well, if you give it too much power, then there will be problems. Now, we also saw that perhaps the way process is budgetary constraint. Well, it also, one thing to point out is that we wrote this on our own, we didn't consult with the issue, we did not liaise with the CEO, but we were actually very happy to see that some of the issues that we were picking up comes out as an, or internally was being picked up those things. Now, from our side, as independent researchers, our recommended strategies for dealing with some of the issues that we're raising, that is very important. It might be prudent to expand the containment plans, perhaps through more resources, both human and financial, are needed to do so. An advocacy and awareness raising campaign is essential to handle. This kind of advocacy and awareness raising campaign, I would think that the head hunters, if they are to do so, they may need to look at using community resources. Going out to the people and not waiting for the people to get to there, very difficult to find them. A more holistic approach to complaints, e.g. the case of education, has so.
Yes. In this case, what is important is that what hunters need to link up the issues of complaints and the issues of service delivery. It's very clear that one of the issues that seems to be affecting African people is that they tie in service delivery and issues about language. And this is important to us. A government cannot be efficient if it can't communicate with its people.
Expand the definition of language violation. And text, this is a hard and fast definition, is leading a lot of problems, a lot of issues outside the scope of the local contract. When in fact, we should try and tease apart these so-called labor disputes issues. More muscle power perhaps is necessary to facilitate desire to change. At the moment, contract recommends agenda. If I don't, well, Tantab recommend, then I don't bother doing what Tantab is recommended. Big deal. Now, Tantab needs to engage critically with policies to establish whether these are feasible, taking cognizance of the prevailing circumstances. One uncomfortable situation which we encountered was the fact that, yeah, people can tell Tantab that, no, we have the language policy. The language policy is so bad that it is unimplementable. Now, clearly, that having a policy does not resolve the problem. Because, yeah, it's just having the policy there. It needs to be implementable to be effective. After all, having a policy does not lead to change. It is through the implementation of that policy that can be effective.
The task of it is to monitor the sector. That you have got a policy does not mean you let desirable change. Its policy is unintended effect. And the role of PANCAP is then to see to what extent is this policy having desired change and to what extent is this policy having unintended negative effect. Now, what is it all about? The only thing that we can say is that the future is now, tomorrow is today. Thank you very much.
You have the end of the
future, that's why we think the future is now.
Oh, the future is now.
Okay, tomorrow is today.
Meant for Pantha. You are from Pantha or Pantha?
Yes.
finalize what they are supposed to be still out there, whether they are getting ready for money or not. And these are the outcomes. Yeah? Good. Honorable Grandmaster, so Honorable Zutuna, Honorable Mazbu, Honorable Kuching,
yeah, Chairperson, thank you very much for a very comprehensive and educative presentation, I must say. The fact that people are not coming to you is because they don't know about you. I was in one meeting of one agency created by legislation and funded by government. They were telling us how much lot of money they have, but the problems that they're supposed to resolve, you know, are becoming hopelessly and hopeless, in the forefront on a daily basis. And what we are saying was that the ability and success of any organization is not about how many conferences, boardrooms, slides, it does, but it's about outreach. Who's your target, and how do you make your target to be aware about your existence? So that they get into that. I think that is quite important. Maybe just to respond to some of the comments. I understood the CEO, and I think this was also alluded to by the two learned gentlemen and the lady there. The issue of organizational redesign and review of this chancellor. Personally, I welcome that. You know, there's no organization that can exist without reviewing whether it's still what it was created to be. Also looking whether even what it was created to be is still relevant. I think that is quite fundamental. It's a defining life, you know, of any organization. But now I want to check that in doing this exercise internally and looking on the external factors, broadly speaking, whether you have had an interface with the Parliamentary Committee on the Review of Chapter 9 Institutions. Because this is my first question, Chairperson. I'll just preface it. Maybe it's important that they need to. Yeah, this is Chapter 9. This is Chapter 9 Institution, Honorable Member. I came to this meeting quite clear, you know. When is it Chapter 9? It's the Chancellor, okay? It's not like Tito Mboweni's board, ne? It also has similar powers, reserved then, ne? But it's on another chapter of the Constitution. The Chancellor is Chapter 9. Yes. Members are very surprised. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. The point I'm making is because Parliament has also acknowledged problem, a legal and the practical lacuna in terms of accountability lines of these Chapter 9 institutions and other independent bodies created either by legislation or constitution. Relationship with the departments where they are accounting. Whether the funding model as it exists currently, is that funding model appropriate? Because some of you are arguing like, no, we don't want to be derive our budget from the department, they want to control us, those kind of arguments. Parliament has created that, and the committee chaired by Honorable Professor Kada Asma. So I want to check whether you have been elected to that committee so that you also put your perspective across. Because for me that would be a noble opportunity for this your own internal review, to also influence Parliament as the lawmakers, even to review the legislation, if there's a legislation that is dealing with yourself. That's the first thing. The second thing, my difficulty with the issue of language currently is the manner in which we are looking at language development and language as a tool of transformation. You know, because we are looking at it only from post-1994. Without locating the new emerging dominant paradigm, which defines every facet of our life, socially, politically, economically, which is globalization. Maybe it is there in your own design, in your policy, whatever, elements and instruments, but it is not as visible as my eyes can actually pick it up. But what is becoming clear with globalization is that, language, it's affecting language in a big way. And the fundamental question becomes, is the manner in which we are pursuing language development in the South African context responsive to the challenges of globalization, whereby, for instance, trade itself define language, No doubt about that. You cannot go and conduct no successful trade in the French no countries or dominated no Franco no areas, ne? Without speaking that particular language. I'm sure you'll agree with me that even Africa itself is partitioned along that line. But that main development agenda of most you know, underdeveloped countries are actually pursuing the old line that we are trying to negate. To ensure that in Burundi, because we are colonized by this country and it's still a superpower, we are pursuing this kind of a thing. No? And this is the trend that I'm seeing in South Africa emerging. Even our own children, they choose not to do the very mother tongue that we are saying. They prefer to be more anglicized because in their own context, no, they see English as a form of business, you know, trade. If you are anglicized, you are amenable to be employed, you know, you are amenable you know, to get you know, opportunities and all those kind of things. No, it's a most unfortunate thing, but it's a reality. I mean, if we read in Gugiwa Chiongo in the decolonizing the mind, you know, we'll understand it far more better. Now, I want to understand, what are your strategic, you know, interventions within the global context, you know, of language development? That will be my second question.
I want to take two questions, and then from there allow you to respond. The second one, I think, one of them.
Thank you,
Chairperson.
I think partly my question was going to go on outreach, but I noticed that the research actually covered it a bit to say there needs to be more of outreach work because really I don't even want to talk about the issue of cheetah hearts, but in my mind it's another person who thought maybe it's an organization that is associated to PAC, you know, an African Congress of Afghan. So I'll add if I can see you all that you need to do more outreach work so that then many people are actually aware if you're familiar with the work of the center. Because then as I am sitting listening to the presentation, you know, I become angry because almost 10 years the organization has been existing, but very few people actually can really take it to be very, very serious. And the issue of language also is very, very important. I mean, there's one person was telling me that in the FGP meeting, parents were voting which languages they should actually add among the curricula. They took French and Portuguese. And I was amazed that, can you imagine, in a smart province like Gauteng, of course, well, it is multilingual, as you said, you find Portuguese people across the Chinese and South and so on and so on. But, I mean, African parents choosing French and Portuguese. Really, is right up in really. Oh, personal status of Frenchness. Sometimes, some of the things, because we learn other apartheid, we say, I learned this because I know I can be able to use it like another banana. So it also links to my question to say, I noticed you've got Department of Education, but what extent do you really, really work with the Department of Education, especially at lower level, whether it's your district or if your SCPs, can't you just organize even one dialogue and invite SCP so that then each time they decide to do the policies between the schools, they identify issues of language to be a priority. I mean, a few months ago, the minister indicated that learners at elementary school, which is the primary, the mother tongue is actually going to be emphasized. People who were asking us, are you African people? But you are one of the Bakari in the man. Abadana Wafunda, Mamadi, school, Bakuna, the Tarantana Bakuni, Israel. And one time after I confronted me, I said to him, you fuck off. Because in the first place, the child can't even calculate right now because the child is being forced to learn in English and yet he's not going to. Well, we are saying, we're going to have a full time of the issue to understand. That is why even the results of the trick will always show you. You go to another case, the father will mean I'm going to have a call. Because Africans is their mother tongue. So it's easier for them to write in Africans. You go to Gauteng, you go to Eastern Cape. One director was justifying why many learners actually fail English. As they come across phrases like, a dog is dog. And they don't understand that a dog is dog. And yet, we don't know how they will understand what does that mean. Which is a slang language, meaning this, 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 and that. So outreach work is very, very important. And also the issue of challenges, I noticed that you alluded quite a lot, but then I won't go deep into them. But also recommend maybe link to research. Maybe a country life, maybe, of people who can even be able to lodge their complaints and actually be able to come on a complaint that will be taken up. And lastly, on salary terms, you emphasize that you don't have full-time staff personnel, but your salary scheme is indicating that it is rising. I mean, I'm full of words, whom are we paying in this money if a challenge is that you are under-resourced, personally, government, human resource, meaning home body, in other ways. Then this salary bill of up to 30.23%, exactly where does that money go? And noticing which issues of law and practitioners, those are the most expensive people. To outsource a person to come and interpret can actually cost quite a lot of thousands of friends. And also, to what extent are you also encouraging young people to take up the career in languages, so that then they also become a language practitioner, they have a space in the world, and lastly, some have a fellow practitioner, they may launch a lot of time, they say, Nina Muzu, Muzu, Noma Muzu, fellow practitioner, they say, Chiamo.
Can we get answers to this question? Because the other person I do recognize is actually the now I have a good answer. Then will come second round of the question.
I would like
to ask a question. Let me say, I think there is a very one. Do you have a couple of answers?
Yeah, the issue
that about,
yeah.
The time to respond to the, some of the research questions that you have. Yes, globalization. Yes, yes, and impact on language. We are increasingly talking about language as a marketable commodity. Right. And then the other issue, I think, about migration, what it has raised is the importance of understanding cross-border languages and establishing collaboration across different countries. Then the issue about outreach is an exciting one because it raises one fundamental issue. If, for example, you were to go to my grandmother and tell her about language rights, how would you frame that particular idea? What exactly are language rights in Kishonga, in Benda, etc.? That, I think, is an important issue. And then the other point that we have been raising about how PANSAB in terms of research, etc., may function. From our own perspective, which experienced in a number of different countries, it's ultimately cheaper to have your own researchers in-house than to dread me and Dr. Duke one in a while. I'm not arguing for a job to pass up, I'm just saying, in a state, what is important. It's much better. When those individuals are in-house, they stay in there. And the salaries that, the money that you spend in commissioning, you're likely to save more if they are within your institution and they're the ones who are largely saving out there.
Thank you, Professor Mponi. Let me then address the rest of the questions because we are running out of time. I would like to respond to the honorable member,
Setona.
Yes?
Setona.
Setona.
Yeah.
And point out that you are quite correct, sir, that an interface between the review committee, which was led by Professor Kada Asman, has taken place. We were called to make presentations in that review committee. However, we have not been called to be given the outcome. This is where I'm coming in, that we definitely need a parliamentary person who is going to be taking care of our interests. We are out there, there is no interface between us and parliament. Yet we are a parliamentary board, we are a constitutional board. This is what I identified in my strategic planning with my team, that we definitely need a parliamentary officer who must be based in parliament so that there is that free flow of information. If the parliament wants information from us, it is speedily sent to parliament. And if there is something that has been passed by parliament, it comes straight to us, not via. Second,
if I may go to the issue of globalization, my researcher has touched on it. But let me say, my brother, we are seriously concerned how Africans, South Africans, have been colonized. I have done the same in terms of the rate of materialism. You can let other languages, that is why we speak of additive marginalism, but we are not saying, therefore, forget about the language. It is not going to pay if we allow globalization to swallow us. We will be going through the same thing that our forefathers went through. We are saying, as Pastor, let us strengthen our mother tongue and let us add on things. Let us add on to Sutu. Let us add on to Kosa. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, I'm Zulu speaking, but I'm living in Gauteng. How do you think I survive? I survive because I'm speaking my Sutu. Never mind how good mental it is, but I am proud that when I meet my fellow African, I say, Jumela. And I say, Kianibu.
Yes.
And this is precisely what we say. Our marginalism is a resource, globalized or not. At the end of the day, if we are talking about businesses that is coming from outside, how many of our people interact at that level?
Mm-hmm.
We must be able to create our own jobs, because in schools we are taught in our languages and we free our minds to think beyond the English language.
Mm-hmm.
English language is actually handicapping who we are and how we are
functioning.
We are not speaking of indigenous knowledge system, which is a bed of knowledge which has not been open to the world. And that knowledge is in our indigenous knowledge system, our languages. How do we know? How do we transfer that knowledge to our young ones if we are going to promote globalization or not globalization? It's related to that, my brother, because we can argue more. And this is where I become very, very excited in terms of addressing the issue of globalization. Let me then go to the issue that we have been given. The review committee has actually identified the issue of the legislative power, which we have identified, which the research has identified, and we need to be given a platform so that we can engage whichever committee to address that one. We definitely are begging you to show us ways how we can engage that committee that deals with the change of legislation. We know we can go to the gazette and all those things, but we need to start by actually, you know, leveling the playing field so that we are all at the same level. Thank you. Let me then go to the issue the issue that has been raised by Honorable Matibuko. You are quite right, Honorable Member. The issue of outreach. But the issue of outreach work requires a lot of manpower down there. What I identified as a problem is the lack of manpower, and maybe the ending is with the issue of salary.
Is it manpower or person power?
Person power. Pardon my gender insensitivity.
English.
Yeah.
Person
power.
You are a woman or one is a
honorable member, let me leave you with the issue of full time staff. We do have a full time staff in terms of administration and managing this language unit. But what I was alluded to, what I was alluding to, is that the provincial members that fall under our unit, provincial language committees, are not in our payroll. They are just ad hoc. The NLD members are not in our payroll. So in each PLC, there are about 30 PLC members who are not in our payroll, and they do this work on an ad hoc and it is coordinated by our provincial managers, and there's only one provincial manager per province looking after the interest of a wide area. We have, for instance, 30 LLBs. They are not in our payroll, but their work goes through
the provincial office to head office where we do all the work. This is what I was talking about. So the money is needed to have more people on the ground. I have come up with a strategy which I call a Panzer Food Soldier, where we have inspectors to inspect how language is used by police in police stations, at court, in our court, in our post offices, in our hospitals. That means a huge, massive complement of staff. This is what I'm talking about when I'm saying let's look at the strategy, how we are going to make ourselves effective. Now, I would like to address the issue of how we engage with the Department of Education. Fortunately, on the 4th of July, I was privileged to meet with the Honorable Minister of Education, the Honorable Naledi Pandor. She invited me to have a decision to discuss this matter. But however, the red tape, you know, for us to reach you, there are these PAs. I told my PAs that please don't one of the people that come working with me. It's so difficult to get hold of you. I'm still trying to associate. But at the same time, the provincial managers, they interact with provincial MDCs in the education source and so on and so on, so that we actually get an understanding around the issues of language. Right now, I'll be going to the Eastern Cape because there's been a complaint from Eastern Cape that the school is 90% black, but the school, a government body, has imposed English and Afrikaans. I'm going to intervene there. I am also a victim. In KwaZulu-Natal, I am paying 17,000 a year for my time. And the school government body imposes a language policy which is contradicting the language in education policy and the national curriculum statement. They have made my choice to take English as the first language and take Afrikaans as the first additional language and take Zulu as a second additional language. That is a violation. And I'm going to be meeting with the school government body on the 5th of August because I am I picked this up when I was receiving the what called the what called report, which is the first term report. And I said, how dare they insult me like this? I'm paying so much money, this is what is happening. And it is happening across the board. Mm-hmm. If they can do it to a CEO Panzer, then they can do it to a government. This is what I'm talking about. Because the school government bodies have been made to be very powerful. The HODs of the department have not actually checked the legislation. The legislation says, if the school government body comes up with the language policy, it has to go to the HOD. This is what I'm going to be dealing with as a new CEO. The HOD must own up to their responsibility because it's not happening. This is what I'm raising with the Minister of Education, that let us review how our policies are being implemented. It was picked up by the researchers that it's one thing to have a language policy, this is another thing to have it implemented. Let me then go to the issue of results, method results, which you are reading. You are quite correct. We always see what it is we are coming up first. Mm. So it's of language.
Mm.
Here I am. I've been using English for 36 years. When I sit down to write papers, I have to think. But if I write in my own language, and this is what we're saying, even the method papers have to be in two languages. It is for learners to understand both. And we are saying, my brother, who was talking about globalization, we're not saying away with English. We're saying let us use our languages and English and Afrikaans and others. We are therefore saying it is important that our languages are used in the school system from grade zero right up to tertiary. And we welcome the move by the University of KwaZulu-Natal for allowing our African languages to be used in their tuition. Why not other universities? This is where Kansas is actually concerned. Why other universities are not following suit? So this is what we're saying. This is why we are proposing to have a multilingual institute where we can train people who can then go and study these students. Because I say, so we do not have people who can teach in both languages. Now, if you go to the issue of the toll-free line, that issue is being actually investigated. It's investigated because we talked about it during our strategic journey, that we need to identify an option so that we can have free collapse. The manager in
part of procurement is currently looking into that. Salary terms, I've already spoken to that one. They're about additional reasons. I am going to ask the Zulu editor-in-chief that Parliament has requested. Thank you. And I would like to give one to Mr. Gentile, one to Dube, and then Professor Ufone. Over to you.
Thank you, CEO. And thank you, Mr. President, especially on the issue of dictionaries. This is what NAB has given some of the dictionaries to me. I've tried to call the speaker, I've never got hold of. The secretary always says the speaker is not there, and also what I should have to write a proposal of giving that particular gift. I've tried to call the office chair, and I've never made a breakthrough. And some of you on the board, I should put it in writing. I think Colonel would allude to that. I've got the dictionaries with me, but I've been saying, can I bring them so that we can showcase that particular thing? Even now, I just decided, let me not take one particular issue, let's bring the dictionaries, and then we should take off the major point that you want to discuss about here. And another thing that I want to add on, since 1994, census has been starting to be known. Because we are asking as provincial offices, as provincial managers, as understaffed as we are, under-resourced as we are trying to make proper impact in terms of getting in touch with the people, taking the census money to the people. Some of the particular programs that we have undertaken include the following. I'm just going to summarize in 2 minutes. Community-based projects such as establishment of written class in the languages of these people. When you establish a written class, you have to finance it because people will tell you, I don't have money to buy a book. Go around and try to find sponsors, and publishers will give you the oldest books that they don't want on their shelves. They will never give you the new books as they want. And then in terms of resources, you don't have money to fund them. Secondly, are the competitions that we are running in schools, creating writing competitions in which learners are writing in their own languages. One of the good things in this one, when we give a present to these winners, we are not giving them money. We give them dictionaries to take home and show them to their parents that I've received this kind of a dictionary. You know the excitement that I got when I got into a school to present this dictionary to this kid? And the whole school stood up, the learners stood up, and they were kind of feeling the pain that they're not able to see things going on in their own language. And another level that was engaging all the people, both the provincial and the local government, is the linguistic members advocacy. We talk on issues of community participation in this program. I can allude to several examples in terms of this, whereby for instance, a certain policy has to come back to a government institution because of the issue of communication. When you, the act here, the procedure and parliamentary procedures and also legislative procedures require community involvement in the public of any act. But the question then that you ask, which languages do you use? Recently, yesterday, Minister of Local Government said there is no particular issue that is causing the riots that are around the country. People are taking the streets for things in the country. There is no particular substantial issue, but it is communication. The question is, why miscommunication? When you communicate, is a sender going to a receiver? The channel is very important. If the channel that you are using in terms of our government, are not eligible to get the receiver understand what is being said as English on this in the system, we are still going to see this by more of them coming. We also deal with also issues of mother tongue celebration. You go around schools, you go around communities, you invite parents to be part and parcel of engaging on language related issues. Good example in the Western Cape. The MEC has gone to the extent of establishing, adopting what's called the language transformation plan, which promote trilingualism, three languages that are officially in the province, and yet engage on going into parents' quarters to inform them of the plan, and having to be piloted in the next year because of the World Cup. There are International Translators Day, International Literacy Day, and also some kind of cancer awards for people who are making strides to do things and businesses in their own language. These are kinds of projects that we are undertaking in provincial offices that are not yet seen in the broader public due to the fact that we are very, very under-resourced in terms of these things.
And over to you, Dr.
Briefly, I would like to respond to a question that was raised across the table by one of the respondents. That is, African parents choose English rather than their their own language. I think sometimes it is very easy for interception to take place as a statement of fact. The reason why I'm saying this is that quite a number of people do believe, and the media is also not helping, that African parents want their children to learn English, speak English and all that. Because the media tells you, and once in a while we hear it here and there. And yet, from a research point of view, clearly, if there are different sites where you look, and possibly when you zoom there, you think, ah, no, African parents want their children to learn English. But when you look broadly, when you open the spectrum, African parents are not so pro-English that parents not so pro-English like the media would like us to believe. I'll give you an example of a project that is going to be published, which we did with Professor McConney on naming practices. That is a fundamentally cultural experience in most African communities. We hypothesize that if African parents are pro-English, then they will be naming their children more and more in English. That trend will become more and more prominent. We started our research by looking from 1960 up to 2006, looking at how parents are naming their children, how African parents are naming their children. Naming is an expression of culture. It is very distributed in African cultural experience. What is wrong was that parents were naming their children, giving them post-independence, Zimbabwe in South Africa, what emerges is the effect of the promotion of African languages, when more and more parents are beginning to name their children using African languages. You find people being Undombento, no Toboza or Togozila, whatever they name them, they start to get two names. Like in African languages, or even more names in African languages. So we therefore felt that the impact of these projects where African languages are being promoted is being done perhaps piecemeal, in a piecemeal manner, like it is there, is picking up momentum. And therefore, the claim that parents choose English may be meaningful, but it is not just may be something that we observe because it strikes us. But this is not specifically significant. Coming to you say about the issue of globalization. Well, from where I think globalization simply makes the whole world into a global village, where portability becomes very easy. Hence, English or African languages have been so portable to the extent that they are now dominating in America. In America, you even have an African language teacher association that has set standards for teaching African languages in the United States. Who are the teachers? They are teachers from South Africa. In fact, I know Imantata Odris, who is now the director of teachers in the United States. The American children, realizing this global state, they want to learn African languages more than they are interested in English. And therefore, to me, globalization does not constrain the use of African languages. And it doesn't mean pro-English. It just means that we all are aware of our needs in our own
country. I never thought I would spend a day arguing that George Bush has got one thing right. But let me say this.
just continuing what my colleague was saying. There are now more teachers of isiZulu in the United States and increasing than in South Africa. And this is a very, very sad state of affairs. And the issues about the teaching of African languages and isiZulu in the United States, the first course in the teaching of isiZulu started in 1958. And they are going on and on teaching African languages. Why is that happening? George Bush has managed to realize that security and languages are interlinked.
Honorable Chair,
yes,
let me allay your fears. We have at the moment Americans living in our African home because they want to get isiZulu. There's a project the lady that was the previous speaker, Dr. Dube. It's happening. I've got evidence that Americans teach African isiZulu teachers are genuine isiZulu speakers, but not in South Africa, and you are quite right. And this is the point that we are raising with the Minister of Education. How come are the standards in South Africa so low that they let people who can hardly utter a good sentence in isiXhosa and isiSuthu to stand before our children and teach? Where are the standards? This is the issue that I would like to raise with the minister. Yet, when I was in the teacher training fraternity, I trained teachers who could teach first language and second language. What does that mean to those teachers? They have not been employed because we have not taken the issue of transformation and integration seriously. Our children are being taught by people who do not understand because people are actually holding their job. It's still reservation of jobs as we knew it in the public apartheid system. Parliament has got to intervene. That is a critical issue that we as councils are raising, that the standards have to be maintained. The standards in teaching our African languages have to be maintained.
Yes, small thing. It's just a follow-up question. Maybe when they round up the money. Sir, the point I'm raising is, we cannot benchmark. And I really need a symposium. We cannot benchmark ourselves with the U.S. Because the intentions are not about transformation. The intentions are about maintaining the status quo of power and domination. I like what the learned gentleman has said, security issue. So that they must be able to infiltrate a person who they are suspected is a terrorist or whatever, ne? Speaking Zulu, speaking Sultan, whatever. Ne? So I think there's a problem there. But overall, I agree with everything that you have said. That, for instance, there's an anomaly, absolute anomaly in my view, in our context. You've got constitution which says this, about language. I think Faith has captured this quite correctly. And the Faith, it belongs to us. I think it does not belong to Pancala. But there's an anomaly somewhere there, Honorable Chair says it. Your school's ad says that the school governing body, it ravishes, no? For a lack of a better way. It ravishes the whole good intention. Because I'm a minority in where my kids are schooling. You know, even when I vote, they vote there. And they're not wrong. The law says that they must vote in medium of instruction. Yeah? And the majority of people say, no, we prefer Africans, we prefer what. My kids are doing Khoza, and I'm not a Khoza. Well, I don't have a Khoza. I've compromised. Because I don't have a test. I'm in Cape Town. But now, the point is that we cannot benchmark with America because of our relation in the global context. Well, of course, they're doing a good thing, but for different purposes. But I agree. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I see on quite true that Bentham is quite keen in promoting multilingualism and so forth. He also mentioned the question of sign language and the two of the 10 languages which we all know are not official languages right now in South Africa. But my question here is that I would like to hear from Foundstaff and maybe the department as well. Is the intention at the end of the day to make these languages official languages in the country? The reason why I'm raising this is that the two of the 10 languages are really the indigenous, one of the indigenous languages of the Republic of South Africa. Those were the very, very first people who occupied this area. So forth. But yet, up to today, it's not yet an official language. Now, and where I come from in the Northern Cape, we do have cool and French-speaking people. And I think there's a place called Platfontein, where we have a school trying to implement the program and so on. But the fact of the matter is it's not yet one of our official languages, so I would like just to hear from maybe the department or from Canada what are their views on this particular
profession. Thank you,
thank you, Chairperson. It's not much with me. I just need more clarification here in the right to language as against a right of language. If you could just elaborate for the matter, it is very clear. And I want to support, because I was going to raise, if you are promoting this pencil, why don't you give some incentives, competitions for children and so forth, so that they'll be attracted, you know, just like you do in science. Yeah, as you do in science. Competition and then incentive for those who are doing it, to give them a self-esteem. And those who are not doing it, to envy them. So I think that gentleman over there mentioned awards. Promote this award, success this award, we'll be watching and seeing. If it comes true. Thank you.
Before you answer, because our time, just one small thing. It looks like you really want to think about the in the legislation of Panther. And the reality of the situation now is that you are actually pulling Panther, you know, the educational bodies that are actually reporting to other cultures. That's where you are going. That's where you are to find it from, or everything. And one of the thoughts that maybe you need to, as you engage the Department of Agriculture in terms of bringing about the amendments in the legislation so that you are able to realize that issue of the real one, to realize as you engage that Department of Agriculture. And you want to avoid the bias. But for now, as the legislation stands, is that you are represented in Parliament by that lady there. that's how it stands now. For as long as you are, not mind you, is that you're not as power with public protector for you. You're not as power with public protector. You're not as power with other institutions that are set here, for instance.
For instance, the South African Human Rights Commission.
You're not as power with that. You aren't as power, for instance, with the Auditor General.
Correction, I'm glad to show you.
Yeah.
This is where I keep my mind.
Yeah. I think people might
confusion.
Yeah, there is a big confusion. They are chapter 9, these people.
By chapter 9.
They are chapter 9.
Yes, they are.
They are.
Yes, they are. Let me show you. It's a thing that this one is not.
Can you bring my name?
This is where we were actually. That is said, those institutions that way is we are a chapter 9 and therefore we are at par with the public protector.
Sure.
What was challenging that why are we treated differently from other institutions?
Sure.
I will raise the section here if there is a
constitution. Now, I don't want you to answer that. But the fact of the constitution and passed by this parliament.
Yes.
does not put you as part. You may want to be a part.
No, Chair. Chairperson. No, you are an old constitution.
No,
there is a constitution must meet the schedules of the constitution. It's very important.
No, no, but you see, the constitution here is actually stipulates all those institutions.
You must meet the schedules, Chairperson. There was Adrian van Niekerk. I learned this thing. I didn't know. There was a man, Afrikaner, from Nationalist Party, Northern Cape, for those who were here. He taught the whole NCOP about pamphlet and why it is derived. You know, he used to make a whole issue about it and it interested both of all of us.
I don't care what you know, it's in relation to that, but the fact is this constitution, not as a Because it is the Department of Arts and Culture that funds you. You're not funded directly by Parliament. You're not. You're funded by the Department of Arts and Culture. That's where your money comes from. That's the reason. And the funds of public protection does not come through any department. They don't come through any department. They are funded directly. They are funded directly from the shares of this country. Directly. The Human Rights Commission are funded directly. And if you are, for instance, in the United States, you are accountable to the NGOP for that thing. Then we want nothing to do with you as NGOP. Because the institutions are accounting to the National Assembly. You want to realize the situation where all the languages are tell us, where do you think you'll be able to realize that? Or is it just an open-ended type of a situation? The other issue that I wanted to say is, I'm not very sure if we are starting correctly, because it looks like we are emphasizing on dictionary. Our emphasis is on dictionary. I'm not very sure, because the real thing is actually to promote the language. And how do you promote it? By printing more dictionaries, or by actually encouraging you to for those languages. And especially by the people who speak those levels. I have a problem in the sense that the Department of Education, you know the situation before in the school, where students in high school or whatever were encouraged to summarize books in school in contact with their parents. I'm not saying it looks like The proponents of dignity basically is to say, I'm a citizen. That's my leadership here, but if you can respond to this person that raised to their end, you know, then all other questions are going to respond.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. If you start by responding to the Honorable Member to raise the issue of the code and send languages, what CANSAT is doing towards the making these languages official and the sign language. Currently, there is a dictionary, and we do respect to the chairperson. For the Kokokoa, Africans, Kokokoa, glossary. For us to have these languages to be made to be powerful, they have to have script. Script is the one that made us to the way we are, because we have script. Now we have the script. So if we want to standardize, there has to be something written, and we have started with the Kokokoa to have this dictionary glossary, which is African to Kokokoa. And we are going on with other projects in this language, so that there must be a written script in this language. How will the process then unfold is another issue, because we are mandated to deal with official language. There's another structure, the constitutional code, that deals with languages used by communities, and you're quite right. Since these languages are at the verge of extinction, we need to do something about it. Sign language, actually, though the users of the sign language, South African, are very vocal. They are opposed to CANSAT. That is not to have their languages to be official. So that letter is being actually discussed at the present time in CANSAT. Yeah, then the issue of right to language and right of language, I'll bring it to the center, but not for now. The issue of incentive, we have started what we call CANSAT Olympiad, where incentives are given to learners when they run competitions. But that project could not continue because of monetary constraints, which we want to revive. We have got multilingualism award, which is another way of promoting languages. And we'd like to decentralize this multilingualism award rather than having it all the time done in Pretoria. Let us see it done here. So we take note of that. We will actually try and revolution calling this issue whether CANSAT is acceptable. May I draw your attention? Section 20 of the Constitution, page 155, may I read to you then? It says, in this section, constitutional institution means, one, the public protector, B, the pen of the South African Human Rights Commission, page 166, C, the Commission of Gender Equality, D, the Auditor General, E, the South African Reserve Bank, F, the Financial and Fiscal Commission, G, the Judicial Service Commission, or H, the Pan South African Language Board. It's here. It's here. And I'm saying, if we do not do it, we are therefore having a problem. And this is what actually I was correcting the Auditor General when they were visiting CANSAT. They said, you are not a constitution, read your constitution, I read mine. And this is why I'm the CEO, because I'm protecting this
constitution.
And I'm saying, and I will challenge this. And I'm saying, it's not that you do not want to be under the Ministry of Arts and Culture. I will not say, when we work very well with them. But there are issues that must be addressed. And I'm saying, address this one. And I'm saying, we are being discriminated upon. Because the constitution clearly says that we are a constitutional body. So we want to know, how did it happen that we were singled out? That is the issue that our land is out to address. If we do not belong here, but we want to take it to the correct forum, so why are we being
discriminated because it's a serious thing and it is affecting our delivery. Other institutions are actually given the right budget because they are defined properly. And it is a serious issue for us. And we cannot keep it standing like that. So that it is not like our colleagues are the but it is a serious issue that affects our delivery. Which is one issue that we have highlighted as a serious thing that we need to address. Thank you
for mentioning. I think it was very well to step off this presentation. It is clear that there are many issues that this needs to
hold. We need to invite them again. Invite them again.
Would love that.
Yeah, no, definitely. If it depends on what we shall agree upon, whether we invite them again or not. Because if we finally agree that they are a chapter 9 institution, we'll never invite them again. If we agree that they are a chapter
9 institution, we'll never invite them
again. But if we agree that no, chapter 9 institution is not accountable to the SOP, accountable to the NSO, to the rest of the thing,
the production of dictionaries should not and must not be allowed to be the main intellectual preoccupation of us. The production of dictionaries in the world of linguistics is a minority effort.
Mm-hmm.
The production of dictionaries was the main preoccupation of a colonial enterprise. To continue with that is to learn to make concept amenable to a colonial way of thinking.
Thank you. Thank
you. I'm happy if you recognize
that. Chairperson, you know why I preface my input on the Honorable Kadasmas? Committee. It's because what the lady is saying there is what the head of the Human Rights Commission is saying. For record, there's media here. This is the media of the committee. It's not about argument. I am saying that committee is dealing with concerns of all these legislative and chapter 9 bodies. Okay? And I think there's a clarity here. What is the status of this? And the argument that you are raising is being raised. You have gone through preliminary report of the Kadasmal Committee. It's the argument raised by the Human Rights Commission. It's the argument raised by all chapter and institutions where they say we want to get our money directly from Parliament. No? And there's a test of war. Because on the other hand, Constitution also says policy. He runs from where? Not from Parliament. From the executive. So when we engage, even on the conclusion of that report, we'll have to persuade whatever position we are taking. We'll have to persuade the executive. No, I just wanted to put this thing in context so that it is not taken out of context by people who are reporting here. And tomorrow we confirm that out of context. Thank you.
I think we have a step of panel, but it is clear that there are issues that is clear. So we will come to you again if you finally agree where we are and I want to once again thank you very much for this presentation, and I can only wish you well. The direction we wish you and me. It does look like we really
I am very much.
How long?